you would be patrolling the beaches at night every night against these sort of mobs of locals that were also patrolling the beaches, and whoever got to the turtle first basically could claim those eggs. So it was quite a mad experience, but hopefully we did make a difference to some of those little baby turtles.
Welcome to The Consult Room, the podcast that celebrates pets and people. I'm Dr. Paul Magtalo. I'm a veterinary surgeon with a passion for the rich insights and stories about pets in the modern world that we live. Whether you're a pet owner, a pet professional, or you just love hearing about pets, then this is the space for you.
So really excited to be joined today by Justine Shotton, who is the head vet at Marwell Zoo. Justine, good morning. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing really well, thank you. And it's really great to talk to you and really excited about the chat.
Most people, when they talk to you, say, I always wanted to be a vet. But how many people say to you, I always wanted to be a zoo vet? Because I would say that to you, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people do say that. A lot of people are really interested in what it involves, what a day-to-day life is like as a zoo vet, what sort of animals we see and deal with, and how we even approach them and treat them, with all the challenges associated with working with wild animals and sometimes dangerous animals as well. So yeah, lots of people do say, wow, that would be incredible to be involved with, or can I come and have a look around, and that kind of thing.
So you graduated from Bristol, but you went on to volunteer in some wildlife rehabilitation centres in Guatemala. Talk to me about that. What did you do there?
Yeah, so me and a few of my friends from uni, we all graduated, and after such a long and tough course, we really needed a bit of a break. So we wanted to do some travelling around, but we also wanted to use our veterinary skills that we'd now finally managed to achieve and get, and do something good for conservation. So we did a bit of research between us, looking at some of the various conservation work that was being done out in Central America, which is where we decided might be quite fun to go. And then we planned a more or less about a 3-month trip, including some stints volunteering at both the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center up in the north of Guatemala and also a sea turtle rescue initiative on the coast. And both of those experiences were incredible. I mean, the rehab center was where mainly seized wild animals had been captured by the authorities and taken to the center. And it had a really good ethos, so it would only keep animals that were fit for rehabilitation and release back into the wild. We really believed in that as an approach. And our jobs were, on the whole, more husbandry, looking after the animals, feeding them, chopping up veg, that kind of thing. But you'd go into the cages of spider monkeys or howler monkeys, for example, with a huge bowl of fruit chopped up, and they'd just sort of dive bomb you to grab their breakfast and then run off. And we used to have to go digging worms for the armadillo baby, for example. So some really fun experiences there. And then the turtle center. So in Guatemala at the time, it was legal for members of the public or harvesters to go and harvest the eggs for food. So there was a whole industry around that. But there was a sort of respected rule that if the conservationists got to the eggs before the others did, then the conservationists could dig up the eggs, carry them over to the centre, bury them in the sand there, and then they'd be protected. So you would be patrolling the beaches at night, every night, against these sort of mobs of locals that were also patrolling the beaches, and whoever got to the turtle first basically could claim those eggs. So it was quite a mad experience, but hopefully we did make a difference to some of those little baby turtles.
So I've never heard of people eating turtle eggs. Was that considered a delicacy, or was that considered just staple food?
No, it was considered a delicacy. So I think they fetched quite a high price, which is why there was that demand for them. So it's a bit like many of these exotic animal products that are seen to have some health benefits or be an aphrodisiac or that sort of thing, or be highly prized by society, with no evidence for that whatsoever, of course. But that's why there was that demand for them, and why we had to be really proactive as a conservation group as well.
I actually spent some time at London Zoo, and at the time there was quite a number of raids going on to top-end London restaurants who were selling bushmeat, you know, kind of under the counter, as it were. And the pathology department at the zoo were being kind of instructed to test the DNA of seized meat to find out the species of it. And I was absolutely horrified that in, you know, central London, in a high-end restaurant, you could have a word with a chef and get something that was not only illegal, but also so detrimental to wildlife and conservation. I mean, I presume that's not happening anymore. We're going back 20 years, but you know, it's really scary, isn't it, to say that even in London, you can see that.
I think that is absolutely horrifying, and I'd agree. And I haven't heard of that, at least for mammal species, in recent years. I have heard cases of some fish species, for example, still being on the menu for the general public that are actually critically endangered. So I think it's really important to be aware of some of these things, particularly when we're all eating out in sushi restaurants, for example, and just know that what we're eating is sustainable and farmed in an ethical way, of course.
And why do you think people do that?
I don't know. I mean, many of these things are traditions based. I think many of the products from the natural world, particularly from plants, for example, did have health benefits. And we know that through science now. And we've developed pharmaceutical drugs off the back of some of those agents, like aspirin, for example, related to willow tree bark. But I think for some of these other products, it is more to do with that, the value of society, the exclusivity of it, belief systems passed on from generations, lack of education about, you know, what is actually in these products. So we know that rhino horn is just the same as our fingernails. And if we tried to sell our fingernails for the same price as platinum, you know, we really wouldn't get anywhere. So I think that it's we really need to get the right messages out there to the consumers of these products, not only through education, but also through influential people advocating for conservation and making sure people don't use these products. Because if they think there's a lot of behavior change studies that have shown that actually the way to get people to change their behavior, particularly from some of these very traditional uses of animals, is to really inspire them through people that they believe in and trust, in terms of influential people.
So going back to your experience volunteering in Guatemala, did that set the scene for you to on your career path as a zoo vet? It sounds like an amazing experience.
Yeah, it was a really amazing experience. I had already in the back of my mind had the seed of wanting to do something around wildlife or conservation work throughout my life career. I did my elective in final year, so we get to choose a block of sort of seeing practice, as it were, at a specialist centre. And I chose mine at Bristol Zoo and managed to get in there. So I'd already had a few weeks as a zoo shadowing a zoo vet, and we got to do some great things there, like anaesthetizing and health checking the gorillas, which was really fantastic, as well as seeing some other species that I really hadn't dealt with before. So I think that I'd always pursued opportunities to facilitate that as a potential future career, but I knew that I really needed a solidify my veterinary skills in general practice and working with the species that I've been trained to work with, so at dogs and cats and cows and sheep and horses, etc. Because it's really essential to build up those skills and to learn the communication skills. Whereas in a zoo context, you're doing something often for the first time in a new species that you've maybe never even heard of before. So you need to be really familiar with those basic principles first.
Yeah, and we actually had similar kind of career paths at one point. So we both went and did the Masters in Wild Animal Health at the RBC Zoological Society of London. How did you find that experience at Masters?
Yeah, I thought that was an incredible year. So I did that after about five years or so in mixed practice. And I was really committed to doing it. It looked like a brilliant course. It had vets from across the world, so really diverse group of people, and it was run in parallel with non-vets, so conservationists, zoologists, and that gave you a really interesting aspect. And not only did we have clinical rounds sort of on a weekly basis with the London Zoo vets and pathologists and Whipsnade Zoo as well, but we also learned the sort of science of conservation. And I hadn't really, as a vet student, been exposed to that so much. And actually, conservation is really evidence-based scientific study of how we can help to support these creatures' biodiversity, the natural world. And I hadn't fully appreciated quite how scientific it was, you know, because you hear it and you think, oh, you know, it's great to help save the animals, but you know, how are we actually going to do this? So it really opened my eyes to that. And I was especially lucky because I managed to get a research project looking at the interactions of wild cheetah in Botswana living on farmlands. So we were putting some tracking collars on them, which self-released after a few months of collecting data. And it was very clever. So whenever they went to their marking tree, and cheetahs in Botswana live in these collaborative brotherhood groups, so they grow really big and hunt quite big prey together, which is quite unusual for cheetahs, but they also use marking trees. So we put a data collection wireless box on one of their marking trees where they go to spray and mark their territory. And that then uploaded the data, so the memory card in the collars didn't get full too quickly. So we looked at data of their movements around these farmland areas, and also through looking at fecal samples, you could tell what sort of hairs of which animals they'd eaten were in there. So whether they were predating more on the wildlife species or on calves or goats or sheep. And obviously the farmers would be really unhappy with cheetahs and leopards if they ever ate their own sort of farm species. But we worked out there with an NGO as well who were doing some great initiatives around guarding dogs. So they have these beautiful big dogs that live with the herds of cattle or sheep or goats, and really protect against predation from cheetahs and leopards as well. So yeah, really interesting throughout.
That is really interesting. I go back to my time when I did some work in wildlife and conservation. I absolutely loved it. I did a research project in the Gerald Dool Zoo in Jersey with primates, looking at the contraceptive implants that they were using, because obviously they were, you know, mixing sexes and things like that. So to prevent kind of, you know, this population explosion, they would use human-based contraceptive implants in some of the primates. But obviously a lot of these animals were supposed to be always ready to be reintroduced at some point, but a lot of them were still in captivity, you know, quite a few years later. So we were looking at some of the impacts on health on long-term use of these implants. And it was just really fascinating working alongside those amazing species. I loved it.
Yeah, definitely. No, that sounds really good. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was lucky enough to go out to South Africa as well and look at game capture and translocation. And again, just one of the best experiences of my life. But for me, and from a personal perspective, I'd always wanted to work in wildlife and conservation. But when I graduated, I probably did it the wrong way around, to be honest. I went and did my master's in wild animal health quite quickly after graduating. Mm-hmm. And then I came out of the master's pretty much like you said there, knowing that I had to build some, you know, kind of functional surgery skills and things like that. And actually went to work in charity practice to build those really, really quickly. But then found trying to get back into wildlife and conservation that at the time, you were expected to do a lot of things for free and to volunteer. Mm-hmm. And obviously at that point then I, you know, still had quite a significant amount of student debt and obviously I knew the value of, you know, a salary because I was getting one. And I just really struggled with the concept of competing for, you know, these jobs. I think I applied to go out to Borneo to work with the orangutans, and I had some primate experience, but they were expecting to pay quite a lot of money as a vet to go and work there, and so that kind of almost put my plans on hold. And obviously then life happens, doesn't it, and
yeah,
you go down a different career path. But I still look upon wildlife and conservation as just such a great experience. I just wish it had paid more at the time
and yeah,
I could have done it as a job.
Absolutely. And you know, it's still the same now. I think it's a dream for so many people, but unfortunately marrying that up with the reality, many of the NGOs just don't have the money to fund you know, volunteers, even if they're highly skilled or professionals. And it's really rare to be able to get a paid job as a vet working conservation, apart from, for example, as a zoo vet. So all that sort of field work, as amazing it is, and I completely echo that. But yeah, it's really hard to make that your living. And in a lot of these countries where they're doing more and more conservation work, they're using vets from their own countries. In Kenya, for example, the Kenya Wildlife Service only uses Kenyan vets, so there's less opportunity. And that's absolutely the right way that they should be doing it, and owning that conservation ownership side of things. But yeah, it's really hard to get the experiences or the career that, you know, we all often dream of. So I do feel very lucky to have found a job in a zoo which does do conservation work, and is part of that bigger picture.
So for people that are listening who are not necessarily familiar with the work of zoos or the work of a zoo vet, just could you summarise what do zoos actually do?
So zoos, as well as being places where members of the public can come for, as it were, entertainment to see these animals, they have a really strong ethos around education. So they really want to showcase not only the diversity of species in the natural world, but what is happening to them, what threats they suffer from, and hopefully through having that eye-to-eye experience with some of these incredible charismatic species, that can then help to inspire people to care about them enough to, for example, support conservation initiatives or change their behaviour in terms of recycling more, for example, and supporting the natural world. A lot of zoos, and definitely all the sort of conservation zoos in the UK, it's not the same across the world. Obviously, there are very good zoos and very bad zoos internationally and globally, but the good zoos do also have a strong conservation focus. So, for example, at Marwa, which is the zoo that I've been working in, we were part of an international reintroduction program for scimitar horned oryx, who are these beautiful, quite big antelope species with amazing horns that go all the way back about 2 meters long behind them. They were actually hunted to extinction in the wild. They were completely extinct in the wild, and they only survived as a species in zoo populations. But they actually bred very well in captivity. So zoos managed to keep them going, which is, again, a sort of another function of zoos, to keep these sort of ARC populations for if the species do go extinct in the wild because of loss of habitat or predation or human hunting in most cases, then they haven't been lost to us and the world forever because we can reintroduce them. And that was a really well organized program, with the oryx coming from all over the world back into the Chad area, where they're now breeding in the wild again and have been released by a few years of work. And some of the oryx that we had, their offspring are now part of that reintroduction program. So things like that are really great things that zoos do, and we care about not only the big charismatic species that I think the public are really inspired by, as am I personally, like tigers and rhinos, but also some of the really small but very important species for ecosystems as well. So we also work with partula snails, which are these tiny snails about a centimeter long maximum, and they've been predated by a invasive snail, so a bigger snail that was introduced by people sort of accidentally, and we are also reintroducing those to the islands where they originated from and breeding them in captivity. So it's really across the board, and zoos do a lot of work on that, as well as funding projects in range countries. So our conservation team does a lot of work, both scientifically in terms of funding support for things like Amur leopard tiger conservation and snow leopard conservation as well.
That's really interesting, because you always think, don't you, about zoos, and like you said there, there's always the, I suppose you could call them the money makers, couldn't you, in terms of, you know, and when I spent a bit of time at London Zoo, that was very much, they were putting a lot into primate enclosures because that was what, you know, attracted people and brought people through the door. But equally important are those lesser known species. And I remember spending a lot of time learning and working with these tiny little frogs that were so indescript that you could hardly see them in the foliage. They were very brown and nondescript and everything. But the conservationists in the zoo were so excited about having these frogs there. But obviously the public were kind of like, well, yeah, they're a bit boring, you know. So it's getting that right balance, isn't it, of raising money, raising awareness, education, but then having that really positive impact on conservation and wildlife.
Yeah, definitely. And I know some zoos have done a lot of work in trying to engage people with those sort of little brown boring species or you know, invertebrates or frogs, as you say, because it is hard for us. And I think as humans, you know, we do associate with big, bold, bright animals, and it is amazing to see an elephant, you know, it's or a tiger. These are incredible animals, polar bears, you know. We can have that debate about whether some of these species should be in zoos or not, but I do think that seeing them is a incredible experience for any of us, whether that's in captivity or the wild. But I think it's really key to remember that all species across the board are important, and just because we don't have that maybe same personal experience when we see them, they're so important for making sure our ecosystems are healthy and supporting the lives of all of those other species. So everything plays its role, and it's all interconnected.
This episode is sponsored by Superdog from Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company. Like all members of the family, your dog needs a balanced diet that includes a range of vitamins and minerals to stay healthy and full of vitality. Superdog's chewable, tasty braised beef tablets are packed with over 21 nutrients, expertly formulated for your special companion. Superdog's available now at Amazon, Ocado, Paws, Superdrug and Vitabiotics.com.
From your work in conservation, wildlife and zoo, what would you say is the biggest global threat at the moment?
Biodiversity loss is at its fastest pace, you know, in many hundreds of years. And that's linked to things like climate change and invasive species and disease. So, for example, with amphibians, there's a type of fungal disease that spread really across the globe that's wiping out millions of species of amphibians very, very quickly. And we think probably that started from moving some of these species of amphibians, so frogs and toads, across the world, and then that spread the fungal infection together potentially with things like climate change. We're also seeing animals adapt, so maybe I've heard things like bird song, even in cities, they're starting to sing earlier in the day before the traffic noise comes, for example. So some really interesting things. But I don't think that most of these species can adapt quickly enough to the urbanization, to the new diseases, whether that's zoonotic diseases. So those are diseases that we can give to animals as well as they potentially can give to us. And, you know, the loss of habitat is really extreme. I mean, there's very few places that are truly wild left. Most of these wild areas in the world are now managed by people, at least on land. I think the seas may be a little bit better at its very deepest levels, but, you know, fishing and the fishing industry is having a huge impact, and our behaviour and our growing population are having a massive impact on animals, you know, throughout the world. So I think it's really multifactorial. I'm not sure I can pick one. I don't know if I know enough about, you know, weighing them all up to know which is the greatest threat. But I think that we all as humans have a responsibility to make sure that we're aware of some of the ways that we can help to protect against all of these threats.
So you have experience working both as a GP vet and as a zoo vet too. So for people listening, can you explain what the difference is, how you approach that veterinary work differently with those different species?
Yeah, so it really is quite different. So as a GP vet, it's wonderful because you get to see amazing clients with their pets or their farm animals or their horses, depending on the area. And I have worked in all three of those different sort of areas, types of practice. But I think on the whole, you're dealing with problems for those animals and pets. You might be doing routine procedures. So for example, neutering, vaccinations, preventative health, making sure parasite management is correct, and helping talk through, again, the educational pieces around issues with their their pets and chronic conditions and how best to manage those, reviewing cases. And there's a lot of turnover. So you're seeing, you know, a new client every 15 minutes in consultations or doing a couple of surgeries a day. So it's really fast paced, but it's the similar things that you see over and over again, although every animal, of course, is different and every owner is different. And I really do love and miss these days, you know, having that interaction. So that's quite separate from the zoo approach, which is much more preventative medicine, hands off based. So on the whole, our animals at the zoo are, you know, reasonably young and fit and healthy and don't have too many things going on. They don't really get injured unless they get into fights with each other, which is pretty rare. They're in controlled environments. They're not going to run across the field and get scraped up by a barbed wire fence or, you know, eat rat bait around the farmyard when they're going for their daily walk or something like that. So they're in quite safe environments. So the focus is much more on ensuring that their preventative health is managed well. So again, things like vaccination, parasite treatments where necessary, and things like contraception that you already mentioned. So many of these animals are part of international breeding programs. And depending on the space around zoos internationally, you'll get recommendations of whether to breed that animal with another animal or import an animal, etc. So there'll be times when we will need to contracept animals. So it's those sorts of things. Now, as we're getting better at managing animals in zoos, as we're getting better information about nutrition, many of our species are living really into very elderly years and often much older than they would ever survive in the wild. We're also seeing a number of challenges about geriatric health and how to manage that. So a bit like your old Labrador with arthritis, it's very similar in, for example, we had a number of elderly bat-eared foxes, which are beautiful sort of foxy things with huge ears, as the name might suggest, you know, and managing their arthritis with pain relief and as controlled exercise as you can mandate for a fox in a zoo. These are sorts of things that we're starting to think about a bit more. I guess the other really important thing that we focus on in the zoo is animal welfare. So we do a lot of behavioural studies to look at the behaviour of our animals to see if there's any issues. If there are, how can we solve them to make sure that we're giving the animals opportunities to express all of their natural behaviours in the captive environment and really hopefully designing ways of offering the animals opportunities to do whatever they want to do. So whether that's foraging behavior or swinging through branches if they're primates, or grazing if they're a grazing animal. So welfare is a big focus that obviously is important in domestic species as well.
That just, it just really struck me as you were talking there about the obviously, you know, life in the wild is tough, isn't it, for animals? And actually, when you do create these kind of controlled environments, it never occurred to me that one of the, you know, next challenges you have is how to care for all these geriatric old animals that are living a lot longer. I mean, it's quite sweet in a way, isn't it?
Yeah.
But obviously, it's a new set of challenges because, you know, I can't imagine there's many of those foxes running around in the wild on joint supplements and anti-inflammatories, is there?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like every vet has to do for every animal, you always have to advocate for the quality of life and welfare of that animal. And whether it's an elderly pony or, you know, a pet pig or your pet cat in renal failure, you know, we have to be the ones to make the right decision as to when to euthanize those animals too. And it's absolutely the same in the zoo context. So we do have to make those difficult decisions for the welfare of the animals too as well.
There are a lot of people that do object to keeping animals in that way. So what are their main objections?
Yeah, I think some people just feel that ethically wild animals should be kept in the wild and, you know, it's not fair on them because they haven't been domesticated to keep them in an environment like a zoo. I think some people feel like any animal should be free, so we shouldn't even have, you know, farm animals or pets because that, it, you know, puts that pressure on that animal too. So I think there's a lot of difference in opinion. I think that there's very many people that are completely justified in their opinions of some zoos that just have animals suffering with behavioural issues, for example, even if their health is all right, you can see animals performing stereotypic behaviour, which is this chronic, repetitive, pointless behaviour, which we can also see in domestic species as well. But, you know, and I think that people feel like a zoo life can be worse than a natural life. And I think, you know, we don't have all the answers. I think personally that there probably are some species that cope less well with captivity and other species that actually cope very well. I think we need to be mindful that many of these animals in zoos are, as I mentioned before, you know, quite well protected. Although they still might feel the pressure of being eaten any minute, you know, they actually don't have that stress. So they're not having to flee from predators, for example. They're not having to hunt for their food or have days when they're starving because they can't find something. They don't have the disease or the injuries that they might have in the wild. So I think that a natural life is not necessarily better in terms of welfare. Whether or not it's ethically the right thing to do is sort of a different conversation. So I think people feel like either these animals shouldn't be in captivity because they are wild animals and we should leave them in the wild. The problem is with that is where we can't manage the pressures on the wild, those species may well go extinct, whereas zoos have a place in sort of preserving them. And again, whether that's the right thing to do or not is another question. And I think the other set of people feel like the animals are suffering, which is definitely the case for some animals in some zoos. But I would suggest that many animals actually do very well in zoos and potentially better than they would do in the wild.
So you must have some really interesting cases that you've seen over the years working in zoos.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of things that I've been involved with, some of the most dramatic and challenging things have been, for example, anesthetics on some of these really big animals. So we've got a herd of giraffe at the zoo, and we had an individual that had an overgrown hoof. And if that had been a pony or a cow, you know, you would have got it in, picked up his hoof and pared it down. And we do a lot of training in zoos for veterinary management, but in some cases the animals haven't been trained yet, so you're not or you don't have the facility, so you can't safely do that conscious. So one of the most fun, challenging, interesting sorts of anesthetics that I've been involved with are giraffe anesthetics, and they are probably the highest risk of any anesthesia for any animal. So there's so many things that can go wrong. It's very high risk for the animals. Although it's done not infrequently, it is so high risk that we try and only do it when we really, really have to. But you've got to manage the animal sort of falling down when it's had the anesthetic drugs in a very safe, controlled way. So padding up the environment with straw. You have to have a team sort of massaging the giraffe because it's such a high body size. All of that pressure on its muscles can cause you know, muscle issues if it's just left lying on one side, for example, or doesn't have that blood flow being massaged through. You've got to keep its neck in the right position, make sure that there's no kinks, and then try and get them back on their feet as quickly as possible afterwards. So things like that have been really, really interesting and really challenging to be involved with. I'd say similarly, working with some of the big cats is a wonder and a joy, but also one of the most scary things that I've done in my life. And I think you as the vet are always the one that has to control those situations, make sure it's safe for the other people in your team, as well as the keepers that are helping you, as well as obviously the animal itself. And they can really be quite challenging. We've trained all our big cats at the zoo for hand injections rather than having to dart them. So that's been great and given us some smoother anesthetics. But we've done a bunch of dental work on those animals, for example, getting specialist dentists in to help us do root canals on the tigers and the snow leopard as well. So that's been fantastic. And those sorts of cases are really fun.
Yeah, I mean, I just reflects on what you said then. I remember when I was doing my master's, we also anaesthetized a giraffe for hoof trimming, and it was one of the best things I've ever seen. It was very, because you can't let the necks fall on the ground, can you? You have to keep them kind of propped up, and it's a huge, but for me, it was what I found really interesting. And also, I also saw a root canal on a bear. Wow. And we took an elephant's molar out as well.
Amazing.
But all that stuff, like what amazed me about it was the planning and preparation that goes into that. It's literally a project team that I have to kind of plan that whole thing. And, you know, when you're dealing with these big animals, it's dangerous, you know. And like yeah. you say, as a vet, you're kind of responsible, aren't you, to make sure things go smoothly. The vet profession is quite hard to get into. Being a zoo vet is even harder, but there are lots of other careers around zoos and conservation and wildlife. So what advice would you give to anybody who is thinking of pursuing a career in that direction?
Yeah, I think sometimes there's a bit of a misconception and perception that this is impossible, and it absolutely isn't. And as you say, there are many, many ways to get involved. And I think my key piece of advice is to just try and take any opportunity you can. It's really great learning about how to work with some of these wild species, even in our native species. And we've got some amazing native wildlife species here in the UK, and some great charities that do amazing work to help support them. So even volunteering at things like RSPCA, Wildlife Rescue Centres, is really helpful, and they always need an extra pair of hands. For example, you know, helping raise baby birds or baby bunnies and leverets, little baby hares, that sort of thing. So don't just think about zoos. You know, there's some other great ways to get those experiences with wild animals as well. I think conservation needs as much help as it can possibly get at the moment, and it needs really good, passionate people. And you can probably have more of an impact in conservation doing something else than you can as a vet, because really vets are, we're talking about sort of bigger picture disease stuff, maybe helping individual animal moves, but we're not making vaccines that will help protect an entire species, for example. So I think if you're interested in science, there's some really great career paths out there that can help you to make an incredible difference to these wildlife species. Also, even working in terms of more media side of things, helping to educate the public, whether that's in your own country or in some of the range countries, learning communication skills so you can have those really difficult conversations and help educate people, again, is so important. So there's so much you can do, and you can really almost have any career that could have a positive impact in conservation, I'd say. So if you're not sure about being a vet, or you want to work in conservation but maybe not directly with animals, there's absolutely a whole load of ways that you can make a huge difference.
So good to talk to you. Thank you for coming along today. I love hearing those stories about the cases that you treat on a daily basis, and I'd love you to come back and share more of them in the future. But I hope you enjoyed today's chat. I've loved having you here. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's been fantastic.
You've been listening to The Consult Room. I really hope you've enjoyed today's show. Please do subscribe, follow, or share this podcast. I'd love to hear your feedback. If you want to get in touch or collaborate, then do reach out to us at theconsultroom.co.uk, or connect with me on social media as Dr. Paul the Vet or Dr. Paul Magtalo.